This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You have seen food prices going up at the local grocery store. That could be just the beginning. According to Lester Brown, a leading expert in both the environment and world agriculture, those bulging supermarket shelves are part of a food bubble, which could crash. Lester Brown founded the World Watch Institute with its annual State of the World reports. You've seen those. He's written 50 books, won many honors. He's recognized as a thought leader. Now in his own Earth Policy Institute, Brown's new book is World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Lester Brown, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, Alex.
Well, you've been a resource and inspiration to me for years, but our time is limited, so let's dive right into the important issues we face. What is the food bubble, and how does it compare to the real estate bubble?
The real estate bubble, which most Americans are familiar with at this point, was the result of overlending, lending to people who were not really qualified or capable of paying their mortgages. The food bubble is the result of overplowing and overpumping, particularly overpumping. The real estate bubble was a U.S. phenomenon, but it was so big that it sent shockwaves throughout the world economy. And incidentally, when the real estate bubble burst, housing prices in this country dropped 30%. When the food bubble burst, and it's already bursting in a few countries that have been overpumping and overplowing, it leads to price rises, and we will see very substantial rises in food prices. Indeed, are already seeing those.
We've seen some shocking weather events which fit predictions for rapid climate change, the Russian heat wave, the disastrous floods in Pakistan, and right now in Queensland, Australia. Is climate destabilizing world food production already?
We have seen in the past grain price surges when there was some event somewhere in the world. It could be a monsoon failure in India or heat wave in Russia or the former Soviet Union or drought in the U.S. Midwest. But what we're looking at now is more extreme climate events, heat waves, floods, storms, etc. And one of the problems we face is it used to be if there was an event someplace in the world that led to a tightening of grain supplies, we would just wait a year or so, or the U.S. would bring some idled cropland back into production, and then within the year, things would be back to norm. Well, a couple of things have changed. One, we don't have the idled cropland in the United States anymore to bring back into production when things tighten. So we've lost that cushion, that reserve, as it were. The second thing is that with climate now changing, the whole system is changing, there's no norm to go back to. And that, I think, we have not yet quite realized. There's still, I think, a feeling that, you know, if we're patient, things will go back to normal. But there is no normal with climate anymore. It's in constant change now.
Well, what about peak oil, so-called, or rising oil prices and agriculture?
There's always been, in the modern era at least, a link between rising oil prices and grain production costs and food production costs generally, because oil is involved in the production and the transport, the processing, and so forth of food. And that still exists. But there's another link now. Given the capacity we have to convert grain into oil, i.e. ethanol, to fuel cars, the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil. As the price of oil goes up, it becomes more profitable to convert grain into ethanol. And so given the development of that capacity, particularly in the United States, where this year something like 119 million tons of grain out of our harvest of roughly 400 million tons will be going to ethanol distilleries. So what we have created in the world is a situation where the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil, and we know that the long-term price of oil is going to be going up. And therefore, in the absence of government intervention, that is, in the form of restrictions on converting grain into ethanol, the price of grain will follow the price of oil upward.
Lester Brown, in your work, you draw a distinction between problems that are event-driven and those that are trend-driven. Can you explain this and give us examples of trends to watch?
Well, an event-driven tightening of grain supplies would be the heat wave in Russia. A trend-driven tightening of food supplies would be shrinking irrigation water supplies, for example, in many countries. Water tables are now falling in countries that contain half the world's people. And that includes the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States, and includes a number of smaller countries. Wheat production in Saudi Arabia, which was self-sufficient in wheat for more than 20 years, is now in free fall. It's collapsing because all of their irrigation water was coming from a fossil aquifer. That is an aquifer that does not recharge. So once it's depleted, that's it. So we've seen the Saudi grain harvest drop from about 3 million tons a year as recently as 2007 to less than 1 million tons this year. And within another couple of years, they'll probably be out of wheat production altogether and totally dependent on grain imports. According to World Bank figures, 175 million people who live in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping, which by definition is a short-term phenomenon. Our estimates for China are that 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Here in the United States, we know that irrigated area is shrinking in key agricultural states like California, Texas, many other states, including Colorado, for example. So it's quite possible that we don't have good enough data to be certain. It's quite possible that we have passed peak water, peak irrigation, before we pass peak oil. But both will profoundly influence the future of agriculture and world food prices.
What is our food situation now? How good are our reserves? And are people dying due to lack of food, but we just don't hear about it in the media?
One of the things that's happened over the last half century is that famine has been redefined. There was a time when famine was a geographic phenomenon. Wherever there was a poor harvest in the world, there was often the risk of famine. But we have developed an international food distribution system now, not just the market economy, though that's an important part of it, but also the World Food Program, where the UN's World Food Program has relief efforts, I think, in 29 countries right now. And so we have these ways of intervening to avoid a geographic famine, that is, thousands or even millions of people dying in a particular area. But what has happened is that we have redefined famine and made it an economic phenomenon. It's the low-income people in the world, those who get by on $1 or $2 a day, where they may have only two meals. There's some place in the world where families are trying to get by with just one meal a day. And that's really getting pretty close to the edge. So it's estimated that something like 17,000 children die each year, that is children 5 years and below, as a result of malnutrition. And that, when you begin to calculate for the year, comes to, as I recall, 7 or 8 million. So hunger has not left us. It's just it's concentrated in economic groups instead of geographic regions.
In some food-challenged countries, I could name Pakistan among many, malnutrition and starvation are experienced by women first. Can you talk about the importance of gender in the food crisis?
Well, I was hearing a conversation about this at a social gathering just recently. In many developing countries, particularly in Asia and the Middle East and in parts of Africa, the males are fed first and the females are fed afterwards. So there's a tendency to have more malnutrition among girls than among boys, for example. And the same is true for differences in education. If boys usually get priority and then girls go to school if it works out, but they don't get the same consideration. So one of the keys to breaking out of this situation is making sure that, one, that we educate all youngsters, girls as well as boys, and another is to make sure that children everywhere are adequately nourished, because it's a key to their future, not just physical, but mental development as well.
But let me be a bit of a devil's advocate here. I mean, scholars like Dr. Bill Reese, the co-inventor of the ecological footprint, he says the world is already at least 30% beyond its carrying capacity. We've just gone over 7 billion people. Should we try to expand global food production infinitely? Where is population control or even population reduction in all of this?
It's not getting nearly the attention it deserves. Tonight, there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table who were not there last night. And tomorrow night, there will be another 219,000. Many of them, incidentally, with empty plates. And it's this relentless growth of population that's been underway for more than half a century now that is taxing the skills of farmers and the limits of the Earth's land and water resources. And for some reason, particularly the last couple of decades, we've let the population issue fall off the table. And it's coming back on now, and that's the good news. But there are roughly 205 million women in the world who want to plan their families but lack access to the family planning services needed to do so. Now, the cost of filling that gap is minuscule compared with military expenditures, for example. I mean, the cost of doing that would get lost in the rounding of our military budget. It's so small. But it's one of the most central investments we can make. These are not women who need to be convinced. And incidentally, they and their families represent over a billion people, well over a billion people, because it would be at least an average of five people per family for each of these women. So getting the resources to them, they want to plan their families. You don't have to convince them. They just don't have the resources. And it's almost a crime against humanity and certainly a threat to our future not to fill that family planning gap.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Lester Brown from the Earth Policy Institute. We're talking about a world on edge. Lester, how soon and how serious could a food crisis be?
First, I would say that in looking at the future of civilization, I mean, it's interesting, we environmentalists used to talk about saving the planet. But as I think about it, the planet's probably going to be around for some time. The question is, will civilization survive the stresses that are beginning to build? That's the real issue. And it seems to me, though I had long rejected this idea, that food may be the weak link in the system, just as it was for the earlier civilizations whose archaeological sites we now study, you know, the Sumerians, the Mayans, and so forth. Food was the weak link for them, and it also, I think, is going to be the weak link for us. How soon it could be, you know, there's a tendency to think that we've got problems, but they won't really become serious until 20 years from now or by 2050 or, you know, the end of this century or sometime. I think we could be in trouble very quickly, as early as this year, for example. I mean, I don't think it's decades away. I think it could happen any year now. And I would just cite as an example, the heat wave in Russia last summer, when the temperature in Moscow for the month of July was 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm. Russia lost 40% of its grain crop. It was hoping for close to 100 million tons of grain. It lost 40 million tons, harvested about 60 million tons. Now, that led to a 60% increase in wheat prices within just a few months. But in a sense, the world was fortunate, because if that heat wave had been centered in Chicago instead of Moscow, and the U.S. had lost 40% of its grain harvest, we would have lost 40%, not of 100 million tons, but of 400 million tons. So the world would have lost 160 million tons of grain from this past year's harvest. That would have created chaos in world grain markets. It would have dropped grain stocks to the lowest level in history, well below what they were 3 years ago in 2007-2008 when grain prices set historic highs. If that heat wave had been centered in Chicago, grain prices would have gone off the top of the chart. Food prices would have started rising everywhere. Grain exporting countries would have begun restricting exports, or in some cases even banning them altogether, as Russia and Argentina did with wheat in 2007-2008. And as Vietnam, the number two rice exporter, did with rice, and a number of other countries as well. So we would have grain exporting countries restricting exports to try to keep their food prices under control. And then the next thing would have happened is the oil exporting countries would have tried to barter oil for grain in order to make sure they could get the grain they wanted. And then the rest of the world would have been on its own, because there's no guarantee anymore that the world market will supply grain just because you need it. And so there's been this loss of confidence in the market, and we could quickly move into a chaotic situation where, instead of watching the smoke and the fires and so forth in and around Moscow on the evening news, we would have been watching food riots in scores of countries around the world. Governments would be falling, and more states would be failing. And the loss of confidence in the world market, we forget that there's a certain amount of confidence that makes the world market and the world economy function. When you lose that confidence in the market, then things begin to unravel pretty fast. And that's how close to the edge we are right now.
Well, Lester Brown, in addition to tracking a number of threats, you are famous for doggedly presenting solutions, including the book Plan B, now updated to version 4.0. Can you briefly outline just a couple of the solutions to these problems?
Well, one of the things we need to do is to cut carbon emissions fast. Political leaders like to talk about cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2050. We think we have to cut them 80% by 2020. And that would take a major effort, but it would be centered around restructuring the tax system, lowering income taxes and raising the tax on carbon. And that would lead to a rapid restructuring of the world energy economy, a shift from oil and coal and natural gas to wind and solar and geothermal energy. We see the world building a couple million wind turbines over the next decade by 2020, and that would be more than enough to back out the world's coal-fired power plants. Now, 2 million wind turbines sounds like a lot, but we build 70 million new cars a year. We're talking now about restructuring the energy economy to cut carbon emissions and stabilize climate. We're talking about trying to save the Greenland ice sheet. And I sort of use the Greenland ice sheet as a metaphor for civilization. If we can't save the Greenland ice sheet, and if we have to face a 23-foot rise in sea level as a result of its melting, I think civilization is in deep trouble. So this is one of the things that we think we need to do. And it's entirely doable. And then there's so many things we can do with efficiency, replacing incandescents with compact fluorescents, and now increasingly with LEDs. LEDs cut electricity use close to 90% from incandescents. And the head of Philips in North America says that by 2015, half of all the light bulbs sold in North America and Europe will be the highly efficient LEDs, and by 2020 it will be 80%. So we could close at least 700 of the world's 2,400 coal-fired power plants just from lighting efficiency gains alone, which would also make money for us. It's a profitable thing to do. That's an example of the kind of thing we can do. I could talk about electrifying the transportation system and shifting to light rail in cities, high-speed inner-city rail to plug-in hybrid cars and all-electric cars. And the idea of running a transportation system on carbon-free wind energy is really, I think, a very exciting one. Not only exciting from an environmental point of view, but economically, the cost of gasoline, the electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline would cost about 87 cents. So we're looking at some cheap, locally available energy as we begin to develop our wind resources.
Well, we are running out of time. What would you like to tell listeners about your new book, World on Edge?
First of all, they might want to read it. It's not only available in bookstores and on Amazon, of course, but it's also available online. So you can read it, you can download it, you can browse through it, whatever you want, free of charge. The concluding point I would make is that while we environmentalists have been talking about saving the planet, it's really civilization itself that's at stake now. And saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We all have a stake in the future, and we all need to become politically involved. I mean, we can make changes ourselves. We can go from a car to a bicycle. We can change our light bulbs. We can recycle our newspapers and so forth. But we've got to change the system now. We've got to restructure the world energy economy. And that means becoming politically active, becoming part of the movement to close down coal-fired power plants, or joining some of the groups that are working to stabilize world population, or developing a world-class recycling program in your community where you recycle almost everything. That recycling leads to enormous energy and materials savings and greatly reduces pollution. So those are the kinds of things we need to do. Each of us needs to become a political leader in our own right.
I'm Alex Smith. You've been listening to Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute and author of the new book, World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Lester, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
My pleasure. The book is available on earthpolicy.org. Free of charge.
That interview with Lester Brown contains some surprises for me. For example, if LED lighting can close a quarter of all the world's coal plants, Bring it on. But why does Brown keep talking about big climate legislation in the United States when we know the immediate prospects are hopeless with the new Congress and Obama waffling? EarthBeat radio reporter Daphne Washam asked just that question during an hour-long press briefing this week. Lester Brown's reply is about the tipping points of social change and why we keep on trying.
The thing to keep in mind is that change comes very quickly and unexpectedly at times. And in thinking about social and political change, I have sort of three models that I use. One is the Pearl Harbor model, where if you'd conducted a poll on December 6, 1941, and asked the American people, should we get involved in the war or not, probably 95% would have said no, nothing doing. But if you'd asked that same question on Monday, December 8th, probably 95% would have said yes, we have to go to war. And the thing that changed, of course, was the very successful, from a military strategic point of view, of the Japanese attack on the U.S. fleet in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And that changed everything. Now, with climate change, for example, if we reach the point where we have a Pearl Harbor, it might be too late. Another model that I use is I call it the Berlin Wall model, where you have attitudes changing and opposition building and building and building until suddenly everything changes. And the visual manifestation of the political revolution in Eastern Europe was the Berlin Wall coming down. But the interesting thing was no one saw it coming. You can't find a single article in the political science journals written in the 1980s saying, you know, there's a big change coming in Eastern Europe. And after the wall came down, the White House called in the intelligence community leaders here in Washington and asked, you know, how come they didn't warn them about this? Well, not only could the agency not warn the administration, they had trouble explaining it after it happened. And that's what tipping points are like. They're sometimes difficult to define, but even when you define them, it's hard to tell exactly when they're coming. And I think as climate events continue to unfold, that we're going to see a major shift in public opinion despite the heavily funded climate denial campaign. At some point, it'll just become obvious to everyone. And here I go back and remember the smoking and health issue in the closing decades of the last century. And right up until the end, the tobacco company CEOs were willing to testify under oath that there was no proof of a link between smoking and health. And then suddenly everything changed almost overnight, and the industry agreed to compensate state governments to the tune of $254 billion. That's almost $1,000 for every person in the United States. And no one could have seen that or saw that coming. So change comes very quickly sometimes. I mean, in the mid-90s, there was no lobby in Washington stronger than the tobacco lobby. And now there's hardly any major lobby at all on tobacco. And don't forget that the book is online and the press release is online at earthpolicy.org.
That was Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Get a lot more green radio as free MP3 downloads from our website, ecoshock.org.
Eyewitnesses have described a wall of fast-flowing water that appeared before them like an inland tsunami.
You have seen the awful footage from Queensland, Australia, people, cars, indeed whole towns swept away in fast-moving floods. The area impacted was the size of France and Germany combined. Three river systems filled up and powerful waters damaged the city of Brisbane. It is not the first time. In 1974, Cyclone Wanda flooded Brisbane, but in the last 12 months, flash floods hit all over the world, from Brazil through Pakistan to Sri Lanka. It is hardly normal weather, but is it climate change? From Australia, I'm pleased to have Professor Matthew England on the line. He's from the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Matthew, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be with you.
We'll get to that climate question in just a minute, but to start with, what are your impressions about these Queensland floods and what it means to Australia now?
Yeah, these are very devastating floods. Brisbane is one of our largest cities in Australia. There's lots of infrastructure built up right by the river there, and the floods there are the worst since 74, and before that it was not back till early 20th century, 60, 70, 80 years ago. And even in the 30 years since the last floods, a lot of very low-lying infrastructure was built up on that river system, so there's massive damage, and of course there's been loss of life, and the whole state of Queensland is reeling from this event, and there's a massive cleanup underway as we speak.
I think people around the world are feeling for Australians at this time. What is the meteorological explanation for these floods?
Yeah, the main thing going on here for this season is a very strong La Nina event. It's probably the strongest on record, or the second, depending on how you measure a La Nina event. La Nina events are characterized by quite cool water in the central and east Pacific Ocean across towards the US, and then much warmer water north of Australia. So that's the first main reason, but there is very likely to be a climate change signal in there as well, because the waters north of Australia are particularly warm this year. They're actually the warmest ever measured, and the warmth of those waters dictates just how strong the monsoon seasons are. The fact that they're the warmest on record, it's not surprising that the summer rains up in northern Australia have been as intense as they've been.
So why do warming oceans lead to more flooding on land?
Yeah, so a warmer ocean, I mean, basically the oceans provide the energy for the monsoon system. So the rain systems that you see in the tropics over South America, over Africa and over Australia, Indonesia and so on, these very heavy rains that occur in the summertime, they're driven by the warmth of the oceans. And put simply, the warmer the oceans in the tropics, the more intense the rainfall patterns are. So if you warm the oceans, whether it's via a La Nina event north of Australia or via global warming, you do tend to put more moisture into the atmosphere, and that drives more intense rainfall.
We tend to think about increasing heat on land like the Moscow fires this year, but I guess a lot of this greenhouse-caused warming is going into the sea. Are scientists monitoring these ocean temperatures around Australia on a regular basis?
Yeah, globally there's a whole program to keep a really close eye on the temperatures of the oceans, because you're right to say that global warming, a lot of the warming we trap with greenhouse gases is being absorbed by the oceans. And that's a tremendous thing, because it's actually reducing the rate of global warming on the planet dramatically. I'd argue it's also a dangerous thing, because it actually gives people a sense of complacency, in the sense that the rate of warming is relatively gradual, and there is payback. And what I mean by that is we can't just see the oceans absorb this heat without any downstream impact. And what I refer to there is firstly something like global sea level rise. As the oceans warm, they expand. But also, as we're seeing at the moment, intense floods can result from a warmer ocean. Over in North America, we saw Hurricane Katrina a couple of years ago. The energy of that storm system was driven by very warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico. They were so unusually warm that it was either a freak once in 1,000-year event, or it had to be driven by long-term climate change. So these sorts of events, increased flooding events, global sea level rise, and also effects on ecosystems with a warmer ocean. These are the sorts of things that we have to face up to as our reality for the future because of this ocean absorption of heat.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock. We'll continue our conversation with our climate scientist from Australia, Dr. Matthew England, on those crazy floods in the lands down under, and then we'll talk to William Powers about his new book, 12 by 12.